Welcome back. In today's podcast, we're going to broaden our study of the novel by discussing the Gothic literary tradition and how understanding that can help us to understand some of the more central themes of the novel. And to aid us in our exploration, I've invited Mr. Kidd to share his expertise in Southern literature, Gothic literature, and this novel in general. Welcome, Mr. Kidd. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk about the novel To Kill a Mockingbird as a piece of Gothic literature, which basically means that we have a bunch of kids prancing around with black fingernail polish listening to really bad music.
Right.
Actually, Gothic literature, why don't you help us with the definition of what Gothic literature actually is?
Well, yeah, very different from what a lot of people would think. If you describe someone as a goth, you get that picture of somebody with the painted fingernails and they listen to certain frightening music, industrial sounding rock bands, or some kind of frightening face makeup that would go with that. But in terms of literary definitions, Gothic literature is something that, in the Southern expression anyhow, kind of goes like this. This is from a book I like a lot called The Companion to Southern Literature, which is available in our reference section in the Batten Library. And here's how that book defines Gothicism in a Southern context. And then maybe later on we can look back at some of its earlier European predecessors. Many Southern Gothic tales utilize similar myths of Southern society, an inbred patriarchal plantation aristocracy built upon and haunted by a racist ethic, besieged by civilization and democracy, and ultimately defeated as much by its own intransigence as by external forces, and an inbred lower class living in extreme isolation in closed communities, which are plagued by economic impoverishment, educational ignorance, religious fundamentalism, racial intolerance, genetic deformities, perverted sexuality, and unrequited violence.
There's certainly a lot in there that applies back to the novel, and we'll get into the specifics of the novel in a section. But let's try to put Gothic literature in a broader historical context.
Sure, and I think to do that, you've got to go back to the Enlightenment. And you think about the Enlightenment in the 18th century as a time of pure reason and getting everything together in a very organized, logical, rational sort of way. And then there's a backlash to the Enlightenment that people thought that vision, that scientific, logical vision of life doesn't encompass everything. And the Gothic is kind of the child of the Enlightenment in a strange way, that it's a rebellion against it. It's to say that there are forces in our world that we don't understand, that we don't control. They're not always rational and headed towards our best interest. They might take us to a threatening boundary of something that is inappropriate, something that is psychotic, something that's dangerous or otherworldly. And you see this expressed in a lot of different romantic writers who respond to the Enlightenment.
Such as?
Coleridge, especially in a poem called Kubla Khan, where he gives us this very exotic, distant realm, and that's a poem that students will study in 10th grade English as they look at English Romanticism in the spring. And Coleridge gives us this picture of an otherworldly, strange place where he finds all kinds of weird images of women wailing for their demon lovers and a sunny dome made out of ice that is just paradoxical and impossible and exotic. And also another novel from that era, Frankenstein, is a Gothic novel. And we think about that as a very scientific novel, to be sure, but it's about the horrifying things that can happen when you get to these exotic and forbidden kinds of realms. But the term Gothic comes from a tribe in Germany called the Goths, and they were a medieval tribe that the Romantics thought were important and sort of exotic and interesting in that pre-Enlightenment sort of way. And Goth came to be broadened to mean anything medieval. And so this was a way to get outside of that perfectly rational Enlightenment realm and to take us to those other kinds of places. I teach American literature, and the guy that I think of as the Gothic example, who just perfectly gives us the whole Gothic warehouse of tropes and ideas, is Edgar Allan Poe. And you can pick your favorite Poe story and find him involved in those kinds of questions and themes.
Well, let's bring it back to To Kill a Mockingbird, and I'll pause here for a reading by our mystery guest reader of the day. Remember, if you can identify the mystery guest reader, to be the first one to leave a comment in this particular blog posting, and I'll throw some bonus points your way. So without further ado, take it away, mystery guest reader.
She was horrible. Her face was the color of a dirty pillowcase, and the corners of her mouth glistened with wet, which inched like a glacier down the deep grooves enclosing her chin. Old age liver spots dotted her cheeks, and her pale eyes had black pinpoint pupils. Her hands were knobby, and the cuticles were grown up over her fingernails. Her bottom plate was not in, and her upper lip protruded. From time to time, she would draw her nether lip to her upper plate and carry her chin with it. This made the wet move faster.
That was terrific. Thank you so much, mystery guest reader.
You're welcome.
Thank you, mystery reader. And again, if you know the identity of the mystery reader, be the first person to post her identity on the blog, and I'll see what I can do about sending some bonus points your way. So I think it's pretty clear from the definition that you read earlier and from a close reading of this scene that that's a fairly standard gothic kind of scene. You have the description of Miss DeBose as being horrible, her face being the color of a dirty pillowcase, which I think is hysterical, old age liver spots dotting her cheeks, and pale eyes with black pinpoint pupils, the knobby hands, and the cuticles grown up over her fingernails. I don't even know what that looks like. But it's a very that certainly is a scene that has its share of gothic elements. And there's others from earlier in the novel. I'm thinking again of chapter 8, in which there's this scene begins with snow, which the kids freak out about because they're not used to it snowing. They've never seen snow before. In fact, Scout's reaction is the world is ending, Atticus, when she looks out the window and sees snow falling. Followed up by a fire. Followed up by the mysterious appearance of Boo Radley mysteriously donating a blanket to Scout to keep her warm while she's outside watching Miss Maudie's house burn down. So the gothic elements are dotted throughout the novel, and not to spoil anything for you, but later in the novel when you read a description of the courthouse in which the trial is going to occur, Tom Robinson's trial, that description is classically gothic. And so you definitely want to be on the lookout for that. But I think, you know, we could spend a lot of time identifying different parts of the novel that are gothic, and that might be worthwhile for you to do when you get some time. But I think a more interesting question for us to talk about right now would be why? What do the gothic elements contribute to the thematic elements of the novel?
Right. You know, I think that gothic always makes you confront something that is other. And that's really a big part of the coming of age story, that you've got to figure out otherness. And it occurs to me that Jem and Scout, as they contemplate Miss DeBose, are in some ways contemplating their own mother. They're looking at an older woman. They're looking at a woman who's a kind of life and death image. And so they're working through a subtext there of thinking about that horrifying fact of their lives, that they are without a mother. And so coming to grips with that for them is going to be a big part of their ability to grow up. Also, when you're born into this world, you don't understand anything about what's going on around you. The entire world can seem sort of gothic. Everything is strange. The logic of it doesn't make any sense. And you don't know about these incredible forces that are in your life and how powerfully they can affect it. You don't know how to manipulate them yet. You don't know how to respond to them. You don't know whether they're good for you or bad for you. It can be an incredibly frightening experience to find that some of these forces don't mean are not interested in your best interests.
And that makes actually perfect sense when you think about the town of Maycomb itself. I often talk about the town of Maycomb as a character, and it's one where everything is strictly defined,
right,
looking at the family stereotypes at the beginning, and everybody knows where everybody's supposed to be and what everybody's supposed to be doing. And any alteration in that brings this
outside, other with a capital O, element into the world, and you can see how people want to push that out. So the Radleys get pushed out onto the margin because they're so different. The people at Old Sarum are sort of pushed out to the margins by the folks in town because that world doesn't make much sense to them. So you can actually start to see this psychology in many different levels throughout the novel.
Absolutely, and I think that Gothic characters are often characters in transition of some kind, and it might be a coming-of-age story. I think a lot about horror movies, and I'm a big fan of horror movies. I like to watch them on Friday nights because no matter how bad your week has been, theirs is far worse. And they're often young people in horror movies who are confronted with some kind of challenge that they've got to figure out and negotiate their way through this. And I think Scout and Jim are positioned in a way. There's a way to read To Kill a Mockingbird as a kind of as a horror movie. I mean, it would have a lot of the same lighting. It would have some spooky music. It would have those kinds of tones. You can imagine the sort of film that Tim Burton might make of To Kill a Mockingbird if he were going to do that. And you see, this is a guy who's gone again and again to things like, I mean, his last movie, Sweeney Todd, and even a comic book movie like a Batman film. He's going to treat it in very gothic and dark kinds of ways.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I think that the idea that you have this scariness out there really does, and just to reinforce this point, the idea that the scariness outside of your comfort zone really does work with the whole idea of coming of age and in coming of age literature, that there is an outside world, it's terrifying, and there's a natural instinct, I think, in many people to stay in the part of the world that makes sense. However, as many authors have argued, that ultimately is something that's going to be more destructive for humanity than helpful for humanity, that part of living is going out into the scary parts of the world because that's actually where true life is. It's almost cheating in a way to stay in your own social or cultural bubble throughout your entire life.
It does beg the question, though, why would people want to be scared? That's one of the paradoxes of horror movies and of the Gothic. Why do you want to dwell on these dark forces and things? And I guess I wonder about that too, but I have a couple of answers I've thought about. One is I feel like it's more honest. I feel like if you're looking at the dark things in life, that there's no attempt for you to be too sunny about everything. You're not looking at things through rose-tinted glasses. You're looking at the world in a way more honestly. And there's also a sense that maybe you're encountering things larger than yourself, and there's some kind of strange comfort in thinking that those forces are out there. And ultimately, I suspect that Harper Lee is attempting to find beautiful things inside those terrifying forces.
Absolutely. And as we get closer to the end of the novel, this would be a good topic for you as a listener and as a student to go back and revisit, is how are these scary images being turned around a little bit? And how does that create more complexity in the novel? Something that I've mentioned to many of you and something that I'll mention on many of these podcasts is that I believe that this novel is one that is thoroughly underrated for its complexity. It's taught a lot of times to younger students. We even teach it in our seventh grade now. Because the story itself can be viewed as simple, but the more you get into this novel, the more complexity there shows up.
Absolutely.
And yet another example of that will be, you know, this idea of something that's outside, something that's other, something that's terrifying, and yet twisted at a certain point to become beautiful. That's great. I really appreciate your insight. I think that's an excellent place for us to get started, and I encourage everybody to spend maybe a little more time thinking about this, posting about this, if you have some other thoughts about this, onto your blog. Moving on to a frequently asked question from Chapter 11. What's the deal with Miss DeBose and the alarm clock? As you're aware, as punishment for destroying Miss DeBose's camellia bushes, Jim and Scout have to read to her each day. During the first few sessions, Miss DeBose would listen to Jim and criticize him for his reading. But towards the end of these sessions, she would become more and more unresponsive. An alarm clock would ring, and Jim and Scout would be dismissed by Jessie, Miss DeBose's maid, who would hurry to her bedside to give her her medicine. As the month of reading progressed, the alarm clock would go off later and later in the afternoon, until one day it did not ring at all. Miss DeBose simply dismissed the children. Sometime later, Miss DeBose dies, and Atticus explains to the kids that she had been addicted to morphine. She was using the distraction of being read to help her beat her addiction. When the alarm clock rang, she would receive her dose, so extending the reading sessions by having the alarm clock ring later in the day was her way of weaning herself from the drug. On the last day, when the bell doesn't ring, Miss DuBose is free of her addiction, and, as Atticus says, she dies beholden to nothing and nobody. So, that's it for this podcast. As always, your feedback, questions, comments, and suggestions for future podcasts are more than welcome. Just leave me some feedback in the comments section of this blog post. Also, don't forget to have a guess at the identity of the mystery guest reader by leaving her name in the comments section of this post. Huge thanks to Mr. Kidd for his help on this topic, and to Mr. Fleener, who upgraded the production from just me and a computer and a microphone in my office to a real big boy recording studio setup with microphones and mixers and all kinds of stuff. So, until next time, happy reading and happy blogging, everybody.